In our study tonight, I would like to direct your attention to Genesis, the 9th chapter. This is a story that we're probably all familiar with. And recently, I had an occasion to discuss this passage with a young man that I'm studying with, and he had some really good questions. And so, as we studied and discussed it, there were a lot of thoughts that came to my mind, and I thought, well, I can't think of anything more important than for us to look at this passage. In studying the passage, we're going to learn some things just about God's plan, but we're also going to learn some things about attitude. Genesis chapter 9, verses 20 through 28. In this story, after the flood, we learn that Noah began to be a husbandman, which means he became a farmer. And he planted a vineyard, and he harvested the grapes, and squeezed the grapes, and he drank the wine, and became drunk. And he lay uncovered in his tent. So he was in a state of undress in his tent. Ham, who was the father of Canaan, had occasion to go into the tent. I'm not told why he went into the tent, but he had occasion to go into the tent where Noah was. And he saw the nakedness of his father, and he went out and told his two brothers who were outside. The two brothers were Shem and Japheth. So Shem and Japheth got a garment, the Bible says. We usually say a blanket because, you know, a blanket would be a nice thing to use, but it says a garment. So I don't know if it was a cloak or what kind of a garment it was, but they got a garment and they put it on their shoulders, the two of them together. So they suspended the garment from their arms like this and they backed up and covered the nakedness of their father. Now when Noah awoke and found out what Ham had done, he uttered the words that are found in verses 25 through 27. And he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." So this is particularly the passage. These verses are particularly the ones that we want to look at, but we'll be looking at the entire context of verses 20 through 28. So we have the curse of Canaan set forth in verse 25. "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And then the blessing of Shem and Japheth in verses 26 and 27. And it seems rather obvious on the very surface of the thing that the curse of Canaan came because of what Ham did, and the blessing that was pronounced upon Shem and Japheth was pronounced because of what they did. Now, as we examine this passage, the first thing to understand is that the primary purpose of this passage is to tell of the prophecy that was made on this occasion. Because both the curse of Canaan and the blessings of Shem and Japheth constituted a prophecy. It is also important for us all to remember that this account was written by Moses. And it was written many, many centuries after the flood and after the days of Noah. So this story was written by Moses. That means that by that time, the Israelites had already come to be a people. There had been a lot to happen. And I'm just wanting you to see that at the time Moses wrote this, a good bit of the unfolding of this prophecy had occurred. Okay? Do you see what I'm saying now? We've read a prophecy, but we have to remember that the time of the writing of the record of this prophecy was much later than this story. By that time, a good deal of the unfolding of this prophecy has occurred, but not all of it by any means. By the time that Moses wrote this, it was quite obvious that the Jews were going to be through Shem. Okay? You have Shem, Arphaxad, Salah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Perez, Hezron, Ram, Amminadab, Nashon, Salmon, Boaz, Obed. It was obvious by the days of Moses somewhat where this prophecy was heading. And so the primary purpose of this passage is to look at this prophecy, which is uttered in connection with the curse of Canaan and the blessing upon Shem and Japheth. Now let's look at the elements of the prophecy. What are the basic things that are involved in the prophecy? Number one, Canaan would be a servant of servants unto his brethren. Secondly, Shem would be elevated above Canaan because Canaan would be his servant. And then third, Japheth would share the tents of Shem. Now those are the elements of the prophecy. So take a moment to look at the elements of the prophecy, the facts of the prophecy, and then we're going to look at the meaning of these facts. So Canaan would be a servant of servants unto his brethren. Shem would be elevated above Canaan because Canaan would be his servant. And third, Japheth would share the tents of Shem. And what does this prophecy mean? Again, I remind you that the writing of this account was not more than 40 years before the children of Israel would invade the land of Canaan. You see, that's one of the things when you're reading an account like Genesis, you're reading about things that happened long ago, and even long before the time of the Israelites. But you must bear in mind that at the time of the writing of this account, the Israelites were already there, and it wasn't going to be more than 40 years before they would go into the land of Canaan. Now, the meaning of the prophecy had to do with the fact that the Canaanites, just one family of Ham's descendants, the Canaanites would move into that land which came to be called by the name of themselves, the land of Canaan. It was that strip of land that lay along the eastern Mediterranean Sea, and you're familiar with the land of Canaan, I think. Most all of us would be. So the Canaanites moved in there, and they inhabited it, and they inhabited it for a long time. But then it would be given into the hands of the Jews, the descendants of Abraham, because these were the descendants of Shem. Okay? So you've got the Canaanites move into this land. The prophecy involves the fact that later on, the descendants of Shem, who were the Jews, would move into that land and would take that land away from the Canaanites. And remember, it wasn't really all that many years from the time of the writing of this when that would happen. When the land was taken, then the Canaanites would become the servants of the Jews. The Canaanites that were left, that were not destroyed, were subjected and became servants. Now there's another thing that is not dealt with in this prophecy. And that is that in the law itself, in the law of Moses, Moses, or God through Moses, told the people they should destroy all the Canaanites and all the Canaanite tribes, but they did not do that. The Canaanites that were left were subject to task work. They became servants. They became slaves. Now, in the passing of time, the Canaanites would occasionally gain strength and would turn the tables on their captors. But then the Jews would gain their strength back, and so on, and they would put them once again to task work, and they would be the Canaanites would be their servants. And by the days of David, the Canaanites were so thoroughly subjected that you never read about anything. You never read anything about the Canaanites rose up and did this or that or the other. You don't read anything about the Canaanites doing that after the time of the judges. So the Canaanites would have this land. But then it would be given into the hands of the Jews, the descendants of Abraham, the descendants of Shem. And the Canaanites would then become the servants of the Jews. Now, God's dealings with the Jews in the Old Testament excluded the Gentiles, the descendants of Japheth. Now, again, much of what I'm telling you, you should already know, and you probably do already know that. In the Old Testament, God dealt with the Jews and excluded the Gentiles. Now, that wasn't because God got angry and just said, you know, I just don't like you Gentiles. No, it was the Gentiles who themselves first rejected God. They rejected God. They didn't want God. They didn't want to be bothered by God. Get out of our lives, they told God. And so God said, okay. And Romans 1 tells us about that process taking place. And so during the Old Testament, then, as God deals with the Jews, He is not dealing with the Gentiles. He lets them go their own way. As Romans 1 says, He gave them up. He gave them up. He gave them up three times in Romans 1. The point is made, He gave them up. So in the Old Testament, we read about the descendants of Japheth. They were there, and they were numerous, many of them. But in the Old Testament, we don't see God dealing with them. But in the day of the Messiah, in the day when Christ would come, the Gentiles would share the blessings of Shem because the gospel would be preached to all the nations. Now that takes us back here to the prophecy, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be a servant. God enlarge Japheth," who would be the main progenitor of the Gentiles. "God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem." So we have the prophecy here of an association that's going to take place between the followers or the descendants of Shem and the descendants of Japheth. Now that association did not come in the Old Testament period. It came, rather, in the days of the Messiah. When Jesus came, and I have a number of verses here that I want to look at with you briefly. Isaiah 49 and verse 6. And this is in a passage dealing with the coming of the Christ. And we have the words of the Christ Himself in verse 5 of Isaiah 49. "And now saith the Lord that formed me from the womb to be His servant, to bring Jacob again to Him, and that Israel be gathered unto Him. For I am honorable in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has become my strength." All right, now focus on that a moment. "And now saith the Lord," but He hasn't yet told us. He didn't tell us in verse 5 what the Lord said. Isaiah 49 and verse 5. But in verse 6, here's what the Lord told him. "Yea, He saith, it is too light a thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and restore the preserved of Israel." Well, He's going to do that. But that would not be enough. That would be too light. "I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth." Now here is where Japheth comes into it. Here's where we're seeing that prophecy back there in Genesis chapter 9 regarding Japheth come to pass. In Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 10. What's interesting to me here, not only verse 10 but verse 12. What's interesting here in Isaiah A number of times in Isaiah, he talks about an ensign, E-N-S-I-G-N, an ensign. An ensign means a flag. It's a flag. Like even in our day, flags have continued to play a part even on the battlefield. But in older times, flags were extremely important in battle because battle was all hand-to-hand, or mostly was. So when you're out on the battlefield and everybody is about your same height, it's hard to tell where is my side? Where is my side? So you'd have a flag over there. Oh, there it is. And you would fight your way over to that flag and then you'd know you'd be with your side. The flag was a gathering point. Everyone understands that, don't you? That's a pretty neat idea. The flag is a gathering point. Now verse 10, and it shall come to pass in that day, guess what day this is, that the root of Jesse, oh yes, Jesse, the father of David, the ancestor of the Christ, this is a passage prophesying the Christ. It shall come to pass in that day that the root of Jesse, that standeth for an ensign of the peoples, unto him shall the nations seek. And his resting place shall be glorious. He's going to be a gathering place, a flag to call the people to him. Verse 12. And he will set up an ensign for the nations, and I will assemble the outcast of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And as he goes on down, he talks about others being involved in all of this. And of course, we are familiar with passages like Matthew 28, 18 through 20, where Jesus said, all authority hath been given unto me in heaven and on earth. Go teach all nations. Now then, the amazing thing is that back here in Genesis 9, when that story occurred immediately after the flood, already we are told that early in the Bible, we are told the basic outline of history, of divine history in broad terms from the time of Noah to the New Testament era. That prophecy that we have looked at back there in Genesis 9, 20 through 28 outlines the history of redemption all the way down to its fulfillment in the days of Jesus. Now that makes that Genesis 9 passage a very, very important passage. Now I want us to notice the contrast between the sin of Noah and the sin of Ham. First, there is nothing specific stated in the passage to show that God disapproved of what Noah did. Now, don't make a mistake. Notice what I'm saying here. I'm not saying God did not disapprove. But I'm saying there's nothing specific stated in the passage to show that God disapproved of what Noah did. There is something specific stated in the passage to let us know He disapproved of what Ham had done. Because the words follow, "Cursed be Canaan." That's pretty good evidence that God did not like that. But there's nothing specific stated in the passage to show that God disapproved of what Noah did. However, the fact is that the mere account of Noah's deed was sufficient in the society in which he lived and in the days of the society that followed to show that this was a very shameful episode in his life. The idea of looking upon the nakedness of one's father or one's mother was a taboo. It was a forbidden in almost all societies. And in this society, for the story to be told of Noah getting drunk and throwing his clothes off so that he might be seen by anybody that walked in, that was a shameful thing. And nobody had to put a sign saying, this was shameful. This was bad. Anybody reading the story knows this is not the high point in Noah's life. I mean, would somebody have to explain to you this was not one of Noah's more noble moments? I mean, we know that. But also consider this fact. There are many, many passages throughout the Bible that condemn drunkenness. So that a story in which drunkenness is mentioned in a neutral manner, that is, there's nothing specific saying God condemned this, such a passage cannot be forced to say that God did not approve of drunkenness just because He did not specifically condemn it in this context. So we need to understand that even though there's not a specific statement saying that God disapproved of this, the whole message of the Bible, the story itself, all of the other passages that are found in the same book, let us know that this was not something that God approved of. And so the sin of Noah was clear. That it was disapproved of God was clear from the record of the whole Bible. But God did not specifically say here that it was wrong, and that's because God was emphasizing something else. And He knew that any reader of this account would understand that this was not something that He approved of. Contrast this with Ham. Whatever the sin of Ham was, it was treated as a much more serious sin than Noah's. Just by the way God reacted, just from what God said, it was treated as a much more serious sin than Noah's. Now, right here, let me caution you, because I said that one of the things we were going to notice here was attitude. You know what we human beings tend to do at a point like this? At a point like this, we tend to look at this thing and we say, well, I thought that what Noah did was a whole lot worse. Do you know what you're doing? You're disagreeing with God. And you are almost putting yourself in a position to say, I'm going to put God and Ham both on trial here, and I'm going to make the and Noah, I'm going to put Noah and Ham both on trial here, and I'm going to put God on trial too. No, we cannot do that. What we have to do is accept the divine record that's given there and believe that there is a purpose, that there is something involved. And my job is not to criticize God. My job is not to criticize what God did. My job is to find out, why was the sin of Ham more serious to God than the sin of Noah? So again, it wasn't that the sin of Noah was just discounted by God, but it was that in the story, what Ham did was considered by God much worse. And it therefore furnished the occasion for this prophecy to be given. Noah's sin involved a weakness of the flesh. And it was a sin. That does not excuse it. But the sin of Ham involved a sin against the order of things. There was an attitude manifested in Ham that was more serious in God's sight than the sin of Noah. A person might in a moment of weakness commit a sin of the flesh, but a person whose attitude is improper toward the order of things is one who is going to live a life of rebellion, and his attitude will lead him into disobedience. It was this that made the sin of Ham so serious in the sight of God. The difference in these two, in Noah and Ham and what they did here, is also illustrated in the behavior of Saul and David. Though from a human standpoint, we look at what Saul did and we look at what David did and we say, oh my, what David did was a whole lot worse than what Saul did. That's in our old human way of thinking about it. Because we're thinking that, yeah, it was bad that he committed adultery. And yes, it was. And he had Uriah killed. Yeah, that was bad. But in God's sight, the attitudes of irreverence and disobedience that Saul manifested were much worse than the sins that David did. Because the sins that David did were sins of weakness, not sins brought about by a basic fundamental attitude he had. What Saul did, he did because he had a basic fundamental flawed attitude. And that attitude involved him in irreverence and ungodliness. And it would color everything he did. And it did color everything he did. And that's the reason why God rejected Saul and said about David that he is a man after my own heart. And so that is the difference. The sin that Ham committed means that he violated the relationship of respect that a son should show a father. Now, one of the things you have to do as you examine this story is you have to think, all right, here's Ham. What did he do? He goes to the tent. Now, did he know that Noah was in there? Did he know that Noah was unclothed? We're not told that. He goes in the tent. Could it have been that he didn't know? He goes in there, sees his father. He didn't know he was going to see him until he saw him. But at that point, what if Ham had said, oh no, oh no. And he goes out here and he says to Japheth, quick, get some garment of cloth. Let's go in here. Daddy has really messed himself up. We got to go in here. That is not the impression that is left. We have to look at the way the sin is handled. We have to look at the way the deed is handled. And the impression is not that Ham went out and told Japheth and Shem that father is drunk and he's really shameful and all that. No, that's not the idea. The idea is that Ham violated the relationship of respect that a son should show a father. And so Ham went out, and as it were, he said, you should see Daddy. That was the thing. That's why it was treated with such severity. Ham violated the relationship of respect that a son should show his father. A son who shows such a lack of respect to a father will also show a similar lack of respect for law and for God. So that the sin of Ham is a sin more fundamental and far-reaching than the sin of Noah. That's the reason why the sin of Ham was considered more seriously. Now then, let's look at the curse for a moment. It might be good if you just have that chapter before you there, back in Genesis 9, as we look at this part of it, the curse. Now, don't you find it interesting that verse 25 in this story does not say, and he said, cursed be Ham. I mean, it was Ham that apparently made a mistake here that God disapproved of. And yet he says, cursed be Canaan. He doesn't say, cursed be Ham. So this means we need to do a little thinking about this. The curse was not, cursed be Ham, but cursed be Canaan. And yet, obviously, it's predicated on what Ham had done in connection with his father. Notice that Ham had other descendants besides Canaan. There was Cush, Mizraim, and Put. Now, Mizraim, that you see there, is the word that is used in the Old Testament for Egypt. So anytime you read the word Egypt in your Old Testament, if you were to look that up in the Hebrew Bible, it would have that word Mizraim. Now, the word Cush, one of the descendants of Cush is named as Nimrod, and yet Nimrod flourishes in the area of Mesopotamia. And yet later on, Cush becomes the name of a country far to the south of Egypt. So Ham had these four sons listed, Canaan, Cush, Mizraim, and Put. So he had other descendants. from these other three sons, besides Canaan, came very many tribes and peoples. So if God had said, cursed be Ham, then what about Mizraim? What about Cush? What about Put? Nothing is said about them. And so from these sons, these other sons, many tribes and peoples, the displeasure of God was shown to Canaan by telling him of the disaster that awaited the descendants of Canaan. I think that that's what the idea of the curse here involved. When we are studying a passage, when we study an idea such as a curse back here in the Old Testament, we need to be careful not to inject ideas of pronouncing a curse upon someone through magic incantation. We have a kind of an idea, you know, to put a curse on someone, as if to make an incantation and we put a curse upon someone. Something awful. Such concepts are quite common in pagan societies. It is reflected in a great deal of our own English mythology. The idea of a magician, a witch, or someone like that being able to put a curse upon someone. Such a placing a curse was what Balak wanted Balaam to do in Numbers 22 through 24. But in the Bible, and here in Genesis 9 and other places, such as in the Law of Moses, where some curse is mentioned being upon someone, a curse in a Mosaic context, in an Old Testament context, a curse was viewed as a separation of one from his loved ones or his society. He would be thrust out. He would be ostracized. Thus Cain was cursed in that he was ostracized from his family. A curse also consisted of whatever disasters came upon a person, a city, or a country. Such a curse was pronounced as rebuke or punishment. Thus the person cursed deserved what they got because of their actions. I believe that the basic outline of the prophecy regarding what happened to Canaan and to Shem and Japheth would have happened anyway, because this whole prophecy in Genesis 9, 20 through 28 is a broad outline of the scheme of redemption. So that this prophecy, which is told here as a curse to Canaan, is a revelation of what is going to happen. But the telling of the disaster that would befall Canaan's descendants was a rebuke to Ham. He was told about this because it would be a rebuke to him, and it would be an indication of God's displeasure. So rather than God saying, now let's see, what can I do to really, really mess Ham up here? I know what I'm going to do. Down the line somewhere, I'm going to let the descendants of Shem invade the land of Canaan. God had already made those decisions. He had already made those decisions. And I'm going to let Japheth share the tents of Shem. Oh, he had already made those decisions. When God had said that the seed of the woman is going to come and he is going to destroy Satan, he's going to bruise the head of the serpent, God was already indicating that the broad outline of this scheme of redemption was in place. But here's the thing about it. Ham could have lived and died and never known that was going to happen. But God said, Ham, this is what's going to happen to one of your families. Canaan, this is what's going to happen. And he was told as an indication of God's displeasure. He was told as a way of rebuke. It wasn't some incantation. But God informed him of something that was very bad news for him. As we read a story such as this one, we may question why God did not come down really hard on Noah for his drunkenness. And He did come down so hard on Ham for what he did. What I'm wanting to look at here is attitudes. That's the last point I want us to look at, attitudes. Why did God not come down really hard on Noah for his drunkenness? Now, as a matter of fact, I don't really know what else God may have said to Noah at the time that we're just not told. I don't know about that. But looking at the story, we consider this question in connection with attitudes. When we do this, we're making the judgment that what Noah did was a lot worse than what Ham did. Whereas God seems to take the opposite view. And we need to be very careful that we not take a view that is opposite to that of God. And we're setting up our judgment above the judgment of God. So we can either say, I'm going to put God on trial here. Because I think that what Noah did was a whole lot worse than what Ham did. Oh, I just shudder at the thought of a teacher who gets in a class of children or young people and evinces an attitude such as that. Because you're telling the kids, I'm taking issue with God about this. You should not ever, ever take issue with God. You must not ever take issue with God. To take issue with God is to indicate a flawed faith. A faith which does not believe that God is all-knowing and all-wise and all-powerful and a God of mercy and wisdom that transcends anything that we know. Do you see, that's what's implied if we take issue with God. So we can either take issue with God about something like this, or we can say, obviously God considered the sin of Ham greater than the sin of Noah. Now my job is to understand why. Not to wonder whether that's so or not, but to say, why? Let me see if I can understand. I want to look here and see if I can understand. My place and your place is not to evaluate whether God did the right thing or not in any given event, but to understand what His thinking was in what He did. Sometimes we may not be able to find that out. When we cannot find that out, then we must accept that the God that we worship is spelled with a capital G and not a little g. And if He cannot know things that I cannot know, then how is He superior? I cannot take issue with God. And I think that's one of the lessons that we need to learn in this passage. So, this story is important in the Bible record because of the prophecy it contains of the future of the plan of redemption. Very fascinating prophecy. Secondary, but still important, is what the sin of Ham involved. We must always remember to focus on the things that God is emphasizing rather than on the things He is not. Anytime we are dealing with a passage, we want to be able to look at that passage and say, what is the chief emphasis in this passage? Now, the chief emphasis in this passage is the prophecy of the future that awaits Canaan and Shem and Japheth. And so when we study it, when we teach it, that's the first thing. And then what other lessons are available, we can also get those as well. So I hope that the study has been profitable. It sure was profitable to me. I enjoy the studies that I have with others very, very much. And they're questions. They ask questions that maybe I haven't thought about before. And it's really a good time to look at these things. But as I studied this, I thought, what a good lesson it is about attitudes. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to present it. If you're not a Christian tonight, look at your attitude. If you're not a Christian, there's a reason why. Now, would you consider that to be a true statement? Whoever you are, if you're old enough to perceive my words, would you say, yeah, that if you're not a Christian, there's a reason why? Now, what's the reason? You don't know. No, I don't think that's it. In fact, I don't know what it is. But there is a reason. What's your attitude? Is your attitude, I want the Lord, I want to do His will, I want to go to heaven? What's your attitude? Look at that attitude. We encourage you to believe that Jesus is the Son of God, to repent of sin, to abandon that lifestyle of sin. Confess your faith, be baptized to have your sins removed. Through the blood of Jesus, to be cleansed of your sins and to become a part of the family of God. If you're not a Christian, we encourage you to become one now as we stand and sing.